But I'm pumped up and ready to go, and I'm so pleased to have here in the studio with us today David Morata. You read his columns in the daily newspaper on Mondays, and of course, lots and lots of faithful followers there, as well as online. His website is moradaonmoney.com. He's the president of Morata Wealth Management. And David, welcome back to The Shilling Show. Okay, let me turn the right microphone up, and there we go.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again.
All right, so there's lots going on in the world today. We're going to be talking generally about, you know, where people can put their money this year. It's a volatile year, maybe no more so than past years, but there seems to be a good amount of volatility. And so I wanted to start out with a broader topic of volatility, looking at what's going on in Europe right now and how it may impact the U.S. markets. And then we're going to get into some of the choices that people have and look at those specifically. There's a lot of talk. There was a headline story on Drudge yesterday about euro parity with the dollar. Right now, I believe it's at about $1.30 or has been around there. I mean, that's a pretty major shift if it were to go to parity. And then they're talking about Greece being thrown out of the European Union. Would you comment on those items?
Yeah, probably the two biggest things that are going on in the world of finance today is the dollar and the euro. And sometimes you can't see it because you measure the dollar against the euro.
Yeah.
But both of them are government systems that are highly leveraged. They've got huge debt and deficit. And the only way out of that is to print money or do the equivalent of printing money in your government systems, which results in a devaluation of the dollar and the euro. And if the euro is devalued faster than the dollar, then you'll reach parity. I remember when the euro was 88 cents on the dollar before it ran up to $1.40.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because the U.S. dollar was being devalued heavily and the Europe had a strong currency. Now it's going the other way and the euro is coming back down again. But both the dollar and the euro are struggling under government debt and deficit that really has to result in printing money. So one way to think about it is if either the United States or the euro just printed money, we'd be out of our debt problem. Huh. So if we just print $15 trillion and throw it out there, it's really just a tax on people who are stupid enough to be holding at the dollars at the time you do it. And yet everyone thinks a dollar is a safe store of value. So the difficulty we have is the very thing that we measure investments by, dollars or euros, is what's changing.
You know, I read a book recently and had an author on by the name of James Reichards, if I recall. His book is called Currency Wars, and he was talking all about this throughout history, this devaluation of money in order to solve problems. And, I mean, is there any safe haven currency these days? People talk about the yuan, but I've also heard that that currency may be in worse shape than the government lets on. I mean, is any money safe? Is there any good currency if people really felt they needed to hold cash?
Yeah, it's interesting. Money was invented so that you didn't have to take your cattle and trade them for my grain in a barter system. And money works best when you trade whatever you have for dollars or currency. And then as quickly as possible, you trade currency back for whatever you really want.
Mm-hmm.
So holding currency is never a good idea. It's holding currency is always going down by inflation, which in the United States has been averaging about 4.5% a year. And so holding dollars is always a tax on the fact that you don't know what to do with them yet. So what's a safe store of value? Well, gold bugs today would say you need to be buying gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
And gold and silver is a safe store of value, but it's not a safe investment because it won't appreciate above inflation. Additionally, gold and silver is highly volatile. So there'll be times when it's more expensive or less expensive in terms of its buying power, and it will bounce around a lot. The other thing about gold and silver is that they are taxed at a 28% collectibles rate. Precious metals and gold and collectibles are taxed at a 28% capital gains rate. That's huge, especially when the government is devaluing the dollar such that the gold is going up by a lot. 28% of that you have to pay tax on.
Ouch.
And so it's not really holding its value because there's a 28% headwind that you're facing into. So if you go through all of that, I would not recommend gold, cash, or anything else like that. I would recommend shares in a company,
mm-hmm.
which generally end up doing better. But the other route to go is to go for emerging market bonds. And there's two things I like about emerging market bonds. They're not dollars and mm-hmm. they're not euros.
Safe on both counts.
Right. So at least if the dollar and euro is going down, emerging market bonds are paying between 4.5% and 6.5% interest. and you can get a safer store of value against the dollar and the euro.
Let's go to the phones, and we do have lines open for you at 977-1070. We're talking with David Murata about best bets for investment this year in volatile markets. Let's say hello to Greg. And Greg, welcome to the Shilling Show. You're on with David Murata.
Hey, how are you all today? I have a couple comments and questions. One, I think it was criminal that Roosevelt confiscated all the gold from the people. And two, should we be on a precious metal standard? Could we ever go back to it? And three, I see our country, if it keeps going in debt and this leftist redistribution of wealth, not only will they confiscate your gold, but they might try and incremental confiscate your property. And I just like comments on those if possible. Thank you.
Yeah, Greg, thanks very much.
Yeah, those are all great questions. Roosevelt confiscating gold, you know, is always looked back on as an indicator that the government can do whatever it wants, and the government certainly can. We in times of crisis, the government uses every crisis as another excuse to take away liberties and to centralize power, and centralized power is part of the problem we have in this country. Could we go back to a precious metal standard? Here is the best way to think of currency, is that the currency should be going up slightly each year by about what gross domestic product goes up by.
You're talking about the volume of currency.
Yeah, the volume of currency.
Okay.
That's very difficult to do, but I think it was Milton Friedman who said he would just pick a flat number by average GDP growth, and he would just try to inflate the money supply that much, mm-hmm. just to provide liquidity. If you don't do that, if you just had a gold standard, like a fixed amount of gold that you used as the standard for your currency, as the gross domestic product in the world continued to go up higher and higher, gold, one ounce of gold, would have a greater share of that gross domestic product because it would be a fixed percent. Maybe mm-hmm. 1 ounce of gold would be a 100,000th of the global economy. And so it would continue to go up. So you could simply hold gold, and it would be going up by more than inflation each year because the GDP of the world would go up. So I don't think a gold standard is necessarily ideal or perfect, but certainly a stable currency is perfect, and that's a difficult thing to achieve given the government incentives not to have a stable currency.
That sounds almost like a political problem as opposed to a functional or economic problem when you say that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it is. The problem is if you simply pegged it to an ounce of gold, then there are other unintended consequences that you'd have as a result of that. But when you let a fiat currency run a fiat currency, then you have the problems that we have today.
So have we ever had a time in the United States of America where we had a period of relative stability of our currency?
Yeah, we've had periods in history, both in the United States and in England, mm-hmm. where inflation has been zero, which mm-hmm. is sort of the ideal of what you're looking for. You're looking for a 0% inflation. We've had periods because of the gold standard where inflation has actually been negative. And that has its own effects and harm, because if you have a gold standard that's held constant and yet the economy is going up, then the dollar is actually increasing in value, and that causes its own problems. No one wants to invest anything because it's better to hold dollars because you get a guaranteed rate of return.
Wow.
And so you know your buying power in dollars is better, so no one wants to put any money to work.
Yeah, this is all very complex, and I'm glad you're here to explain it to us. David Murata is our guest. You can visit him online at murataonmoney.com. We will take your calls on investments and investment strategies in this volatile market, 977-1070. Michael Besseglia is standing by today to take your calls, and we would love to get to you. So stay with us. We have news, and we have weather coming up, and then the Shilling Show will return with David Murata right after this. Louder. 977-1070. That's the phone number if you have comments or questions or even challenges for David Murata. He's the president of Murata Wealth Management. We're talking today about investments in this volatile market and in this year 2012. And a line is open for you right now at 977-1070. Take advantage and don't wait till the last minute. Let's go to the phones right now and say hello to Gene, who's been waiting very patiently. Gene, welcome to the Shilling Show, and you're on with David.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. David, I read your column in the Monday Daily Progress, and I would like to take exception to some of your gone fishing portfolio, better known as sell in May and go away. One you picked was Vanguard Emerging Markets. That stock has been going down for a long, long time. And there are a lot better ways to play the emerging market play. I'm not eligible to give my own recommendations, but that is just not a good way to play emerging markets. Also, you have a high concentration of Apple stock. That is not a stock that you can go away and forget about. You said nothing about stop losses. And then another one that you seem to think highly of was ExxonMobil. There's a lot better way to play the oil market than ExxonMobil. They are getting so big that they just can no longer produce dividends and that sort of thing. But anyway, I'll get off and let you comment on the things I said.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call, Gene. I really appreciate that. And we'll also leave a line open for you at 977-1070. And David, go right ahead. There we go. I'm sorry.
I'm surprised that Gene says that emerging markets, the Vanguard Emerging Markets, is actually where I think we've got our best gains over the last 10 years. Emerging markets is highly volatile. It's like lighter fluid. It's up 30% one year. It's up 30% the next year, and then it's down 50. So you've got to be looking at a very recent history to look back at emerging markets and say it's not up wildly. If you go back 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, any time of number of years, emerging markets is, I think, what's done the best among any of the country-specific items in the world. Emerging markets is interesting because not only has their debt gotten better, but their countries have gotten better. Their debt-to-GDP ratio is down to 40%. The average in the developed world is 100% debt-to-GDP ratio. And the reason what emerging markets have lowered their debt-to-GDP ratio by increasing their gross domestic product, they're just growing like gangbusters and will continue that way, I think, in the foreseeable future. It's so easy in a developed country to be able to grow because they're not developed and they're not industrialized, and all they have to do is to send some of their kids to Virginia or UVA or Virginia Tech. They come back with engineering degrees. They buy the products on the open market. They set up factories. All they need is capital to really begin to industrialize. It's interesting that Gene would say that there's a lot in Apple. I actually, in the article, wrote that if you had this gone fishing portfolio, 2.3% would be an Apple of your portfolio. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest concentration in the portfolio. And I think 2.3% is a minimal amount to put in Apple. Technology is what the United States does best, and that's why we've got a healthy dollop of the Vanguard technology ETF, and we think that should continue to perform well. It's the best performing sector, and it's the least regulated in the U.S. economy. And then for ExxonMobil, the gone fishing portfolio I think has 1.6%. 1.6% in ExxonMobil. Apple and ExxonMobil are the two biggest holdings in the S&P 500. Our portfolios actually have less in them because we have less in the U.S. stocks and more in the foreign stocks than most portfolios. And most people don't realize how much they might have in individual stocks for that as well. But in addition to ExxonMobil doing well, oil will continue to go up in value. So if not ExxonMobil, Chevron's another good stock. These all have low PE ratios, which means they should do well going forward, and it's another reason why we favor them. Gene mentioned dividend-paying stocks, which is another interesting. Dividend-paying stocks is a trend today. It's very hot. We have lots of people come in and say, I just want a dividend-paying portfolio. Dividend-paying stocks is a subset of value stocks, And the odd thing today is that normally you want to tilt small in value, but today small in value is over, it's pricey because the PE ratios are more expensive. And the reason is because lots of people have been tilting small in value and bidding those up. We actually don't think you should be tilting small in value this year. We think you should be tilting back more toward large and blend. And that doesn't favor dividend-paying stocks. There's a number of problems with dividend-paying stocks, even though I know that they are incredibly popular today. We would not recommend a portfolio of primarily dividend-paying stocks.
She also referenced no stop loss, and I wonder if you would go ahead and respond to that as well.
Yeah, we've just come up on the anniversary of what they called the flash crash. And in the flash crash, stop losses lost a tremendous amount of money. In fact, it was because of so many stop losses that we had the flash crash. So the way a stop loss works is if my stock is trading at $100 a share, I can put in an immediate sell order if it goes down by, let's say, 20%. So I can put in a sell order if it drops below $80 a share. I will immediately sell it as soon as I can. And the difficulty with that is what happened in the flash crash is one stock got hit a little bit, and it was a component in both the Dow and the S&P 500. It was probably by a trading mistake, but anyway, it started to go down. And as it pulled down the Dow, it started triggering stop-loss orders. And that triggered stop-loss orders then for the S&P 500, because 30 stocks in the Dow are major stocks in the S&P 500. And that started triggering stop-loss orders across the boards. There were... So the minute the market starts going down and starts triggering stop-loss orders, it triggers more stop-loss orders. If I've set mine at 80, my sell might trigger yours at 70, which might trigger someone else's at 60. And the market dropped basically 50% of its value, and then within hours came up right back up to where it was. Mm. If you sold, wherever you sold, you did not buy it on the way back up. So it was a great way to lose 50% of your value potentially in a matter of an hour, and then the market was right back to where it was. So I've got an article on the website about stop-loss orders, and we do not recommend them. They're a great way to lose money very quickly, and there's no way to sort of make an intelligent stop-loss order.
And Gene, thanks very much for the call. That leaves a line open at 977-1070 if you have comments, questions, or challenges for David Morata. And I don't ever want anybody to ever ask me for investment advice because I've got a lot of bombs. But I will say there was one day I was a genius, and that's when Apple was falling from over 100, and I caught it on the way down at $28 and bought a lot of shares, which I still have. So there was one time I was smart. The rest of the time, I say I hand it over and let the pros handle it. All right, we'll be back after this with our final segment, David Morata and investments in 2012 in the market volatility. Thank you. Stay with us. David Morata is our guest from Morata Wealth Management. He's online at moratonmoney.com. And there's actually a place online for people to sign up and get access to special information, David, because I know you've got a presentation up there for your people who have signed up. So why don't you just tell us what they need to do if they want to get that extra information online?
Yeah, we've been trying to add some premium content for our subscribers, and if you subscribe to our blog, I think there's about 5 different presentations now that you'll get in a confirming email that are all up on the website. Everything from 10 best ETFs of 2012 to how to save on Social Security to there's 5 or 6 presentations up there. And you just subscribe on the right-hand side of our blog. There's a subscription. The subscription is free, and then you get access to all of the premium content.
Let's go back to the phones, and there is a line open for you at 977-1070. We'll say hello to Gary. Welcome to the Shilling Show, Gary, and go right ahead with David Morata.
Thanks, Rob, for taking my call. David, I always enjoy reading your columns in the Daily Progress. As a financial consultant, do you go under the assumption, you know, there's a lot of debate about austerity, so-called austerity versus economic growth, through basically, you know, economic stimulus, you know, some type of pumping money into the system. Do you basically assume with what's going on in Europe with the different elections that representative governments in the West cannot basically hold the course on austerity, that they have to give in to political pressures to basically inflate the currency, devalue it, what have you, that they just can't hold, basically have a balanced budget. They can't cut spending deep enough and long enough to balance the books on the government side.
Yeah, Gary, that's an interesting question. It is. I'll tell it to you in a couple of different ways. First of all, there's a difference between stimulus and devaluing the currency. So a stimulus package is one that throws a lot of money out there in spending for shovel-ready projects and basically flows money into the private sector. I've seen enough studies to suggest that's a very Keynesian idea, and I've seen enough studies to suggest that Keynes was just wrong on that. It does not help the economy. In fact, it hurts the private sector when government just goes out and spends money willy-nilly. So I would think that a stimulus package is always a bad idea. And what a stimulus package does is borrow money, make the debt worse, and then throw the money around in useless places. So I don't think a stimulus package is a good idea. On the other hand, there are ways for the government to devalue the currency without just spending money willy-nilly. What they're doing in Europe is a little bit smarter. What they're doing is they are loaning money to the banks that the banks will then loan out to private sector and other things. The banks will get a profit on the interest on the loans. The government gets a little bit of interest back from the banks. And then the government is actually making money. And how does the government get that money? It just prints it. So the government can print a bunch of money, loan it to the banks, get interest on that. And now the government actually has people who owe them money. And when they get paid back with money, they get paid back with interest. And that actually helps the government. So when the government creates dollars and doesn't spend them but loans them, that increases the money supply and has a better effect on devaluing the currency without running the government further into debt. Now, is that a good idea? Well, it's still a tax on people who are stupid enough to be holding euros while the European Union is doing this, but at least it actually helps solve the government problem, whereas a stimulus package doesn't help solve the government problem. A stimulus package just makes it worse. So austerity in not spending money from the government is good, and that would include stimulus packages. And then devaluing the currency, I think, is the only way that they actually will get out of debt. So I don't know that they have much choice with that. And it's also true that government actions do not have a primary effect on the economy, because government can't just make the economy do what it wants. The economy will do what it's going to do. Even the policies that Obama has put in place that have hurt businesses won't hurt them forever. The economy will recover. No government policy can keep the economy from recovering. It can just slow it a little bit.
David, it's interesting that he brought up austerity, because we've been talking about this here on the program over the past couple of days, because we see it enacted locally, where there are a couple of school divisions and a couple of board of supervisors, one of them being Greene County, which took a very strong position and then buckled as soon as the complaints started, but another one being Fluvanna, who apparently is not going to buckle. And it's like a Chicken Little. The sky is falling. We're kicking kids to the curb. The whole world's going to fall apart because we don't have more money. And so it's showing me that there is no backbone amongst the American public for this sort of thing, because we're talking about a very small thing right now. And imagine if we were into it, what really needs to be put into place. I mean, people would be screaming.
Yeah, the problem with government spending is that there is no... there's no negative incentive to spend other people's money.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Milton Friedman who said the best spending you can possibly have is when the person getting the benefit, the person paying the bill, and the person making the decisions is all the same person.
Mm.
And unfortunately, with government, that's never the case. Is we can influence it politically, we can tax the rich, and we're giving the benefits to someone else sometimes. And those three together make the absolute worst public policy you can have.
And so I've seen a lot of letters to the editor recently, and I think you just hit upon something that I've been talking about as well, is there's never an acknowledgement from the people who are foregoing these austerity measures and saying, give us more money. There's never an acknowledgement of where the money's coming from. They never say, well, you know, we want to help the students, but that guy down the street is going to have a property tax increase, which may make his kids not be able to eat. They never talk about that part of the equation. And that's the disconnect that you just referenced. Instead of people doing all three things, if you're just doing one, you can forget about conveniently the source of the money.
Yeah, and that's true, too, in the way that they spread taxes around. That's why we have a tax on just about everything, and you pay a nickel and a dime here, is because no one has the will to fight nickeling and diming. But when you get nickeled and dimed in 1,000 different areas, mm-hmm. it's just overwhelming in terms of the burden on trying to build any kind of wealth.
It is one thing that galled me about my trip to Washington, D.C. last week was when I went into the store and they were charging me a nickel for the plastic bag to put my goods in when I purchased there. And, of course, I resisted that. But there's not much you can do about it if you actually need a bag. But these are the sorts of things you talk about nickel and diming people. We've got just about a minute left or so to wrap this up. So if people are looking at places to put money, let's talk about them very quickly, the ones we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, there were 5 of the 10 best ETFs that are all country-specific investments. And if you don't like the tax code in this country and you think it's too burdensome, there are 5 countries with more economic freedom and lower debt and deficit than the United States. And those are Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, Switzerland, and Canada. And these are great places to invest. They are all in different sectors of the economy. They have lower debt and deficit. Of those 5, Canada has a rising debt, but it's still not as bad as ours. They do a lot of things right. They all have corporate tax structures that are lower than the United States, and they all make great investments. And so the portfolio that I recommended yesterday is a gone fishing portfolio. It's not for someone who's playing the markets. It's for someone who wants to put it in good places, try to avoid Europe and Japan and other countries with high debt and deficit, and trying to just bank down their portfolio for the long term.
David Morata, thanks so much for lending your wisdom to this listening audience each and every month. I really appreciate it. Online at MorataOnMoney.com. Are there any events upcoming that you wanted to let the audience know? If not, we'll pick it up next time.
None coming up.
Okay. I know you'll have them every once in a while, and we'll pick it up next time it's available. Thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you so much, Rob.